You are not the president or the vice president's lawyer.
He won a case, a big case.
Your loyalty is not to me.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many.
It's to the law.
Well, I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly.
The Constitution.
He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney.
People of this nation to guarantee justice.
Which makes me perhaps the most innocent man anywhere in the history of the United States.
This is Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider and host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about the legal problems of presidents and their associates. Because all presidents have legal problems, but some have more legal problems than others. My co-host is Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor. He writes the Popat Report newsletter on Substack. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So I want to start this week with some of the colorful, high-profile criminal defendants we regularly cover on this show, people who thought they should try their hand at American politics and have ended up in serious legal trouble. First, Lev Parnas, one-time Rudy Giuliani sidekick Lev Parnas. He's been convicted of 6 counts at a federal trial in Manhattan related to a scheme to funnel money from a wealthy Russian businessman to political candidates in the United States in support of that businessman's cannabis business. That is illegal. Foreigners are not allowed to donate to U.S. political campaigns unless they have green cards, and you are not allowed to funnel or conceal their donations. Parnas's defense had been that he lacked the requisite intent, that he was not an expert in campaign finance law, that these laws are very complicated, and that he did not know he was breaking them. And these are laws that have specific intent requirements. You have to prove that people know they're doing something illegal, which is often difficult. Ken, we talk about that a lot on this show, how hard it is to prove these specific intent requirements. So why didn't Parnas's defense work? Why didn't it work to say, well, gee, I'm kind of dumb. I didn't know that was illegal.
Well, Josh, I'm sure this will be a shock to you and our listeners, but it turns out Lev Parnas is not great at communications discipline. And there was a lot of emails and texts and other sorts of communications supporting the government's theory that he knew exactly what was going on. There was a long line of communications among the different people involved in the scheme, and those suggested that they knew the purpose of what was going on and knew what they were supposed to be doing that they were not. As you said, he was convicted of all counts, as was his co-defendant. Remember that Igor Fruman pled guilty in the case some months ago. So all the defendants in the case have now been convicted. And Parnas was convicted both on the theory that, as you said, he concealed the source of funds being a foreign source, which is illegal, and also that he lied about the source of other domestic funds, some including that he had borrowed in his quest to make donations in order to gain political influence.
It had been an open question through this trial whether Parnas would take the stand in his own defense. And this, am I wrong in thinking that this is the sort of defense where it might behoove you to take the stand in your own defense? If it's basically, it's a claim about your own mental state, oh, I didn't know this, I didn't know that, that the jury might want to hear that directly from you. That you did not know what you were doing when you did this. Now, obviously, there are all sorts of downsides to taking the stand that we can talk about. But is this the sort of case in which you might consider having the defendant testify?
You might, but your decision about that is going to be governed by a few things. The first is an assessment of your client and how well they can hold up to cross-examination and how well they can keep things straight in their head. The second is whether there is a lot of evidence with which they can be cross-examined and whether they have made prior communications that the government is going to be able to highlight by using them to cross-examine the defendant, which is really just another chance to get in and emphasize all this evidence and how it contrasts with the defendant's testimony. So nothing in his past suggests someone who is going to be particularly good on the stand. Again, he's not someone who comes off as disciplined. And there were a lot of communications that would have been very useful in cross-examination. So it doesn't surprise me that he didn't testify.
Right. So that's in the press coverage, it sounded like the last thing you're getting at was one of the issues that there's evidence that would have gotten in that was unfavorable to the defense. If he got on the stand, it would have opened up new things for the prosecution to ask about. How does that work?
Well, often there is evidence that's not admissible in the government's case in chief, but can be admissible to attack the defendant's credibility if the defendant takes a stand. That can be prior misconduct by the defendant. It can be other things that might otherwise be inadmissible. And you open the door by getting up and putting your personal credibility, your testimonial credibility at issue. So you always have to weigh that as well. And that's no doubt what happened here.
And this will also be the case with Michael Avenatti, who we'll talk about in a moment. Lev Parnas engaged in such wide-ranging and unusual misconduct, some of it still alleged misconduct, that his trial had to be split into two. He's going to be tried later on charges related to his ill-fated insurance business, Fraud Guarantee, and claims that he misled investors about the nature of that business in order to get them to invest in it. And so some of that stuff that was kept out of this trial could have gotten in if you put him on the stand, is my understanding.
Exactly, because once you put his testimonial credibility at issue, once you put him on the stand like any other witness, then that opens the door to bring up other instances of dishonesty and other false statements he's made in a way that you couldn't under normal circumstances.
But so the thing is, even if your client sucks in certain ways that make it really risky to put him on the stand, you sort of have to think about this from an expected value position, right? If you are very likely to lose at trial anyway, you may need to do a strategy that is risky and has a bunch of downsides in order to obtain that chance of winning. Is that calculus didn't apply here? That there was enough reason to think that the way they presented this defense without him on the stand, that it could plausibly convince a jury, even though it did not end up doing so in this case?
Well, sure. I mean, juries are weird. You never know what part of the story they're going to fixate on. You never know when you're going to be able to convince them to take a particular approach to a story and buy into the, these were just bumbling idiots who didn't know what they were doing. But so putting your client on the stand is not automatically a good thing. It's not automatically helpful. Again, Parnas comes off as someone who would probably be difficult to manage on the stand and who could probably be counted on to say dumb things, even in direct, let alone in cross-examination. So you really have to have a sober assessment of your client's capabilities.
Lev Parnas says he's going to appeal this conviction. So I guess my first question is, on what grounds would one appeal this conviction?
Well, there could be tons of grounds. You could be complaining about what evidence came in, what evidence was kept out. It could be complaining about the jury instructions and exactly how the jury was instructed. The least favorable argument you can make is that the evidence was insufficient, because that's an incredibly difficult standard on appeal to meet. You have to show that no jury could possibly have reached beyond a reasonable doubt based on these facts, taken in the light most favorable to the government. But there's always a ton of things that you can come up with. But, you know, appeals don't that often work. So it's an uphill battle for them.
When defendants say that they're going to appeal right after a trial, do you have a sense of how often that's true? I mean, is filing an appeal cheap and easy enough that they might as well do it anyway if it's not going to work? Or is it like when somebody threatens a lawsuit that you should wait and see whether they're actually going to do it?
Well, you almost automatically file a notice of appeal, which just preserves your appeal. Whether or not that ripens into eventually on schedule an appellate brief that presents your arguments on appeal is another question. And yes, that's the one where people sometimes wind up not doing it because they're told that there are really just no fruitful arguments. But in my experience, most defendants who have taken a case to trial will decide we might as well roll the dice some more and see what we can do on appeal, particularly if there are some colorable arguments.
Lev Parnas is still a free man. He's out on bail. So, I mean, he's under restrictions, but he's free on bail. Judge Paul Etkin determined that he and his co-defendant were not flight risks and could remain free on bail pending sentencing, and Parnas faces that second trial that we discussed. Lev Parnas, along with Igor Fruman, was rather dramatically arrested at Washington Dulles Airport at the beginning of this whole saga with a one-way ticket to Vienna, trying to get out of the country. So what's changed about Lev Parnas between then, when, you know, he was like, you know, trying to get to Vienna on that one-way ticket, and now where we can be confident enough that he's not going to flee the country and that he will be available to be imprisoned at the time that he is supposed to be imprisoned?
probably it's in the judge's mind, it's his compliance with bail terms since he was released on bail. So, you know, the past record of behavior judges take very seriously. And even though the calculus for whether or not to release someone on bail shifts after someone is found guilty, it's not uncommon for judges to maintain people on bail so long as they've demonstrated so far that they can be trusted and that they've abided by all terms and that type of thing. So I do agree with you that someone caught with a one-way ticket to Vienna is in a different position than most of us. But I think likely the degree of bail terms that have been imposed on him and his compliance with them are what swayed the judge.
Also currently not in prison, Michael Avenatti. Listeners will recall Avenatti has been indicted with three sets of criminal charges that was supposed to lead to three federal criminal trials. That increased to four as the charges in Southern California got split into two buckets. To recap all of this, Avenatti has been tried, convicted, and sentenced in New York for his harebrained scheme to extort $20 million out of the Nike Corporation. He's still free on bail from that sentence because he has to wait for his California trials to finish. He awaits trial in California on bank and tax fraud charges that he made false statements as part of his efforts to obtain financing and hold together the house of cards that was his personal balance sheet. He'll eventually be tried in New York over allegations that he stole part of Stormy Daniels' book advance. But first, we need to finish trial number two. That relates to charges that he stole settlements from clients other than Stormy Daniels, including a paraplegic who severely injured himself during a suicide attempt in a Los Angeles County jail and was supposed to have received a multi-million dollar settlement from the county. The trial over those charges ended in a mistrial several weeks ago, as we've discussed. There were some key pieces of evidence that the government failed to provide to Avenatti in discovery, and the judge said this was a significant enough error that it calls for a mistrial and a new trial. And so Avenatti is entitled to that new trial with that evidence in hand. But Avenatti says that he cannot be tried again, that this is double jeopardy. They already tried him once on those charges, the trial that ended in a mistrial, and he has a constitutional right not to be tried twice. Now, Ken, as we've discussed, that's a pretty thin argument. It is normal to be retried after a mistrial. Can you recap, under what circumstances would that be double jeopardy, and is it plausible that those circumstances apply to Michael Avenatti in this case?
Well, so it's generally not double jeopardy when the defendant asked for the mistrial. So if you know defendant makes a motion for a mistrial and gets it, that is generally understood to invite retrial. And there's plenty of cases applying that rule to the exact type of motion that Michael Avenatti made, a motion for a mistrial based on a Brady violation, a violation of the government's obligation to disclose evidence. So it's a very weak argument. The problem here and the tactic that Avenatti has hit on is that a motion to dismiss on the grounds that being tried would violate the Double Jeopardy Clause is immediately appealable. Most decisions a judge makes aren't appealable until the end of the case. A few are appealable immediately, and this is one of them. And the theory is that, as you suggested, the double jeopardy right is a right not just to be convicted twice, but it's a right not to be tried twice. So the theory is that if you go to trial, the right's being violated. So if you make an assertion that a case violates your right to be free of double jeopardy and the judge denies it, you have the right to an immediate appeal. Now, Avenatti made that appeal, even though I think it's a very poorly thought out one that is not one that does not have much legal merit. The government immediately filed a motion for the Ninth Circuit to dismiss it summarily, to dismiss it immediately because it's so clearly invalid. There's law saying that some double jeopardy appeals are so transparently bogus that you can dismiss them immediately. And what the Ninth Circuit has just done is take sort of a middle ground. It did not order the immediate dismissal of the appeal, but it ordered an extremely expedited briefing schedule so that all the briefs of the appeal will be in January. And it said it would schedule arguments immediately thereafter, and that in general, requests for extension of time on briefs and arguments would not be entertained. So even though a delay until January and probably February for the argument sounds like quite a long time, compared to a system system where appeals are routinely taking 2 or 3 years, it's actually quite fast. So the bottom line is Avenatti has succeeded with this gambit in delaying his retrial on this for a while. Judge Selna has vacated the November 2nd retrial date. And so Michael Avenatti will avoid retrial here at least until early next year.
Why wasn't the appeal immediately dismissed? Why did the, as you say, you know, you don't think this is a good argument, but apparently it was not such a bad argument that the appeal was immediately dismissed. So what does Avenatti have to hang his hat on here?
Not much. There's a doctrine that says that if the government, in effect, tricks you into or induces you to ask for the mistrial, then it might be double jeopardy. And there's a somewhat vaguer doctrine that some types of government misconduct could possibly be so severe that retrial after it's dismissed for that misconduct would pose double jeopardy issues. It's pretty clear those don't apply here, but the standard for when is an argument so bad that you can simply discard the normal appellate procedure and dismiss it summarily isn't that a bright line? And what the Ninth Circuit apparently decided is this sure looks bogus, but we're not quite confident enough that it's absolutely bogus to simply dismiss it without full briefing.
Does the high profile of this case make the Ninth Circuit more inclined to at least hear this appeal? That, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of criminal trials happening at any given time that almost nobody is paying attention to. Here, this is something that gets a lot of news coverage. Does that give them incentive to be more thorough, to give a stronger impression that they're hearing Michael Avenatti out on his claim?
I don't know. I would have thought that there'd be an equally strong argument that they'd want to, because it's high profile, prevent him from such an obvious manipulation of the system and dismiss the appeal immediately, because it's pretty clearly calculated simply to delay his retrial. So I don't think that cuts both ways.
Michael Avenatti is 50 years old. He faces, you know, 3 more criminal trials, this retrial, 2 new ones. He received a substantial sentence in the Nike case, although less than the guidelines would have had it, because, and let's be honest, he never really stood a chance of extorting that $20 million out of Nike. So it seemed like a little ridiculous to sentence him on as though he had succeeded. But basically, Michael Avenatti is going to spend a large fraction of the rest of his life in prison. And as he remains free pending these trials, you know, each month that he gets on the front end is a month that gets pushed back, that might be quite attractive to him. And is in this situation that he is in, it's a very bad situation, but he has found a way to stay out of jail for some substantial period. This could be, is he going to be out of jail for several more years waiting for all these trials to finish? Will he eventually start serving the sentence before he's done with the 3 remaining trials? Because it seems like it could be, especially given his, you know, apparent success in obtaining this delay, it could be years before they're done with all of the trials of Michael Avenatti.
That's true. And his instinct to just, you know, push off incarceration forever and maybe I'll find a way out of it is very typical of a con artist like this. So I think the answer is that it's certainly possible, but I suspect that sooner or later one of the judges is going to say enough is enough. You can write out the rest of this in custody. And, you know, that might be after the next conviction, if there is a next conviction. The judge might remand him into custody. The judge might decide that at some point the calculus of his flight risk has changed. He might do something to irritate the judge. The prosecutors have constantly been trying to get him back into custody, arguing about things he's done. So any of those things would happen. So it would not surprise me either way, whether he got put back in because the judge had had enough of him after his next conviction, or whether he rides it out for a couple of years until all these trials are done and then is hit with the big number.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we will talk about John Eastman and his memo about January 6th. This is All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. So John Eastman, one-time dean of the Chapman University School of Law in Orange County, California, his employers at the right-wing Claremont Institute are very upset that the Federalist Society will no longer invite him to speak at meetings because of this memo that he prepared around the very end of 2020, the beginning of this year, laying out a theory of how you could have Vice President Mike Pence interfere in the count of electoral votes on January 6th in a way that would make it possible in one way or another to throw that election to Donald Trump even after he had lost it to Joe Biden. Now, John Eastman is speaking, or he spoke to Conservative National Review. He gave a long interview to the magazine. And what he says basically is this memo doesn't reflect my views. That first of all, the two-page version that people keep looking at, that's a draft from Christmas Eve. The longer six-page version was more subtle and didn't make all the same claims. And really, you know, what I'm doing in this memo is I'm just laying out the various ideas that had been discussed within the Trump legal team. I'm not necessarily endorsing all of them. And in fact, he claims that he disagrees with various things that this memo says, even with a key thing that is in that final version of the memo that he says is not a draft, doesn't contain things that ended up being rejected. He says, you know, these are not really my views. And so I want to step back for a moment and talk about the role of an attorney, what arguments it's proper for an attorney to make, and how that might be different in this instance than in some other instances. So, I mean, first, the general form. Isn't an attorney's role often to find all of the available arguments for a client? Even if the attorney doesn't think the arguments are necessarily good, they may be the best ones available. So in a normal legal context, if we divorce from it, you know, all of the political context and the violence and the various things that happened around January 6th, is it generally proper for a lawyer to be trying to come up with sort of whatever ideas and arguments are available, whether or not he would rule in favor of those if he were the judge?
Yes, but with a caveat. When you do that, it's incredibly important to put them in context and to make it clear whether or not they are likely to succeed, what the countervailing arguments are, what the possible negative consequences are, to help the client make a decision. Because the problem is, a client will, if you present them with a neat-sounding alternative that gets them what they want, say, okay, that sounds great, let's do that. And if you've left out the part where the judge is almost certainly not going to do this, and it's going to have all these bad consequences, and it's going to cost us money, then you haven't given the client good service. So, I mean, what Eastman is doing here in making these claims about these memos is he seems to be saying sort of the equivalent of a guy who makes a giant sign saying kick puppies, but then claims that, oh yeah, but when I was holding up this sign, I was saying, don't do this. because the memo doesn't within it contain the caveats and the limitations and the explanations, putting the advice in context. He claims in his interview with National Review that he personally gave those caveats during the discussions. And in fact, he kind of makes a step, I think, towards trying to portray himself as the hero who convinced them, even though he'd been asked to put these ideas down, convinced them they weren't right, even though other voices say that really he only backed down off of them when cross-examined. So this is a really dangerous way to advise a client, particularly a client like Donald Trump, who is not known necessarily for self-restraint or the capacity to make difficult decisions about things he doesn't like doing.
But wait, I mean, you're talking mostly there about duties to the client, that if you come up with some harebrained legal theory and sell it to the client without being clear that, you know, you don't think this is really correct on the law, you wouldn't rule in favor of it if that was the position you were in. But the issue here isn't that John Eastman failed Donald Trump as Donald Trump's lawyer. I mean, I guess you could argue about that, but I don't think Donald Trump feels that the legal advice that he received from John Eastman was too aggressive. The question is whether there's some sort of broader duty to the law or to the country not to try to convince your client that they should foment a constitutional crisis, that they should take actions that, you know, did end up leading to a significant violent event, that you should not try to convince your client that there's a one weird trick where he can steal an election. I guess my question is, those are all immoral choices that John Eastman got involved in this. I guess my question is that legal misconduct? Did he have any of those duties, or is his duty only to Donald Trump when he's Donald Trump's lawyer?
Well, the primary duty is to Donald Trump as Donald Trump's lawyer. But yes, there is also an obligation, an ethical obligation, not to counsel the client to do illegal things, not to encourage the client into breaking the law and mislead the client. I think the point of the fact that the memos are so one-sided is that I find it, that's what makes it difficult for me to believe that they're not his legal advice or not him urging. Because if they were truly just sort of, let's test out this theory, you would expect them to have some caveats to allow the people listening to them to evaluate how realistic this is and what the consequences might be. Absent that, it just seems like this is this nutcase's theory and he's pushing it as hard as he can to the client.
Was he practicing law? I realize this sounds like an odd question, but it seems like the defense of John Eastman that's being offered now by him and by people around him is that, you know, he was here as an attorney. He was providing, you know, zealous counsel to his client. His job is not to be the fair and neutral arbiter. His job is to advance the interests of the client. And in various other contexts, we don't hold the attorney responsible for the fact that the client did bad things or is trying to get away with those things. You can defend somebody who is really and truly guilty of murder. But I mean, what they were proposing to be done here was not to be done foremost in a court. It was about what to do in the legislature, and that could have ended up as a matter before the courts, although part of Eastman's contention was, I think probably incorrectly, that the Supreme Court would stay out of this and decide that all of this stuff really is just to be decided in the Congress, by the vice president. These are not judicial questions. Is that defense available to John Eastman to basically say, you know, I was just an attorney doing attorney things? It seems like this is a fundamentally political act on his part. He's giving political advice to the then president, Donald Trump. And so all of those usual rules about what it's okay for a lawyer to do, it's not clear to me that they apply.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that he's acting as an attorney or purporting to. He's said that he was acting as an attorney. He's declined to answer some questions about surrounding circumstances on the grounds of attorney-client privilege. His views were being promoted by others like Rudy Giuliani on the grounds that he's this supposedly renowned constitutional scholar, and he's couching it in legal terms. And by his own story, he was asked by some member of the Trump legal team, he can't remember, allegedly, to offer this legal advice. But that doesn't give him a free pass on advising a client to break the law. And it doesn't give him the mere fact you're acting as an attorney is not a get out of jail free card if you're participating in a conspiracy to break the law.
Ken, I want to talk about a story from Hunter Walker in Rolling Stone. Hunter was the White House correspondent for Yahoo News throughout the Trump administration. He produced a number of interesting scoops about Trump world through that time. And this story, which has been getting a lot of attention, has information about what two people who were involved in organizing the rally. Now, remember, before there was a riot in the Capitol building earlier in the morning on January 6th, there was this big protest at the Ellipse outside the White House. Then President Trump spoke at it. John Eastman actually spoke at it. He has information in this story about the contact between those organizers in various congressional offices of conservative Republicans in the House of Representatives working on the planning of at least that part of the events of that day. And I think it's worth talking about what is in this story and what isn't in this story, because it talks about efforts to get these organizers to put pressure on Mike Pence and on the Congress to basically interfere in the electoral vote count, try to throw the election that Joe Biden had won to Donald Trump. It talks about one of these members, Paul Gosar, who's a far-right member from Arizona, dangling a blanket pardon in some unrelated criminal matter that some of these organizers may have wanted, saying that that's something that the White House might do. What I do not see in this story, what's not in this story, is any claim that these members or their offices were involved in the riot itself.
Right. It doesn't seem to support the notion that they specifically conspired or encouraged people to take the Capitol. The story is more about encouraging people to show up and protest. Protest, I think, for a clearly illegitimate end, to try to pressure Pence to do something that was unlawful to overturn the election, but still to protest and to use lawful means to impose pressure. The story doesn't seem to support that these people were, you know, getting bear spray and handing it out or something like that, or anticipating the sort of violence that ultimately happened. The detail about pardons is certainly curious, and it makes you wonder what they thought they were doing that needed a pardon. But that could be in part self-dramatization, and it could be that these people we're dealing with here, this particular subset of Congress people, are more than a little nutty. So,
well, but I mean, what the story says is that Gosar, quote, dangled the possibility of a blanket pardon in an unrelated ongoing investigation to encourage them to plan the protests, unquote. So that doesn't sound like it contemplated they were going to commit crimes on January 6th. It sounds like they were concerned that they had legal jeopardy related to some other prior conduct that they wanted a pardon for.
Right. And it doesn't seem like that shows that they were planning anything in particular going forward that would be illegal.
Right. So I guess, does this story have legal significance?
I don't know that it has a lot of legal significance to the ongoing prosecutions of the people who committed crimes on January 6th. It doesn't seem to. Now, maybe it will develop into something more and become connected to one or the other of the cases that has large conspiracies. Maybe they will be able to trace one of these people in Congress to some sort of conduct that's actually illegal. But so far, no, it seems mostly a political story.
Finally, before we go, I want to talk about Steve Bannon. We talked last week about the January 6th Select Committee voted to say that he was in contempt of Congress. Now you have the whole House of Representatives, all of the Democrats and a handful of Republicans voting that Steve Bannon is in contempt of Congress for his refusal to cooperate with subpoenas from that committee. So where does that leave us? Now it's up to the Justice Department to decide whether they will bring criminal contempt charges against Steve Bannon. When should we watch for that? Is that something that would happen quickly?
I don't think there's any reason that it would take a long time. The statute says it is referred to the U.S. attorney. The U.S. attorney has a statutory duty, the way the statute reads, to present it to the grand jury. It's not the sort of case that would seem to require a lot of investigation or work. So the U.S. attorney's office, typical custom of taking a few years and throwing a bunch of people and documents into the grand jury, doesn't seem like the way they would normally handle this. The calculus is straightforward. He was subpoenaed. He refused to appear, and there you are. So I would anticipate that they would move quickly if they've decided to do it. Now, one thing they might do is to wait a little bit to see how the case that Trump brought trying to stop this proceeding goes, or how any of the other civil cases surrounding the subpoenas go. Because in the past, sometimes the executive has paused these prosecutions while civil cases about the same issue play out. But I kind of suspect they won't do that this time, just because there's so much pressure, and because Trump in the past has so successfully defanged congressional committees by just using defiance, and the delay of the courts has encouraged that. So I suspect we're going to see something sooner rather than later.
And so when you say the U.S. attorney, this is the U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, who's
correct.
Also overseeing all these hundreds of Capitol riot cases?
That's correct.
So this is yet another thing on that office's plate at this point.
Yeah, Steve Bannon could be in court rubbing elbows with the Proud Boys of January 6th.
Well, that should be a natural environment for Steve Bannon. There is much more that we could talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also send us a question at kcrw.com/ATPL. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our production fellow is Nisha Venkat. The show is recorded and mixed by Nick Lamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more of All the President's Lawyers.